Good afternoon and welcome everyone to the Bus and Rail Subcommittee meeting today on Monday, June 13th, 2022. To begin with, as you just heard, this meeting is being recorded and we will be placing the meeting audio on our website, which is wmata.com. Just a few helpful tips for people joining via phone call. You can press *6 to mute or unmute yourself. If you would like to make comments, you can virtually raise or lower hands by pressing *9. Everyone joining via video conference, you can click on the speaker icon to mute or unmute yourself. And if you go under reactions, you would see the hand raise icon. If you click on that, that would raise or lower your virtual hands. If you use these tools, it helps us knowing that there is somebody who's trying to make comments and we can have one speaker at a time. So I thank you for using the tools appropriately in advance. We do have ASL interpreters with us on this call. To help them in performing their job well, I would request everyone to please state your name before you speak. This not only helps the interpreters, it also helps everyone joining on the phone call, knowing who the speaker is at the time. Chair Calabia?
Yes.
With your permission, I can go ahead and read the meeting agenda for today and then take the roll call of the AAC members.
Please do.
All right, thank you. So for today, the Bus and Rail Subcommittee meeting agenda is as follows. After I finish reading the agenda, we will go through the roll call of the committee members. At 4:05, Chair Calabia will go through the motion of reviewing and approval of today's meeting agenda and last month's meeting minutes. At 4:10, we have Michael Haas. He is the interim chief operating officer for WMATA. At 4:40, we will have the WMAP team, Paul Burden and Jankar Sevak, to give us post-pilot follow-up information. At 5:15, we will have Melissa Anderson from Department of Transportation to take feedback of the AAC members regarding floating bus stops. At 5:45, we will have public comment and the meeting is scheduled to adjourn at 6 p.m. That concludes today's meeting agenda. At this point, I would go ahead and take roll call of the AAC members. Please confirm your presence. Darnese Bush. Tino Calabia.
Present.
Thank you. Vanessa Coles.
Present.
Thank you. Rico Dancy.
Here.
Thank you. Deborah Fisher. Marcy Goldstein.
She's here.
Okay, thank you. Steve Caffin. Thomas Mangrum.
I'm here I am.
Okay, thank you, Steve.
I'm here, Thomas
Mangrum. Sure.
Thank you.
Sorry, I was on mute.
Thank you, Marcy. I got your attendance. Chair Calabia confirmed it. Philippa Mazel.
Present.
Thank you. Phil Posner.
Present.
Thank you. Doris Ray. Denise Rush.
Present.
Thank you. Paul Semaphore. Patrick Sheehan.
Here.
Thank you. And Kelly Simona. Okay, that concludes the roster for today's meeting. If any of the members join later on, I'll have their attendance marked accordingly. at this point, I would just do a gentle reminder for any presenters who would be using a visual presentation for their discussion. Please describe it in detail for the convenience of our members and customers who are blind or have low vision. At this point, Chair Calabia, I would ask for you to move the meeting forward. You have the floor.
Thank you, Anu. Everyone heard the agenda as read by Anu. I take it that there's no objections. So without any objection, we adopt the agenda. With respect to the next item, it's a review of the minutes of our May meeting. We highlighted it at our AAC meeting last week. I mentioned that there would be some very minor edits, and those edits were circulated to all members by Anu this past week. And so the item is to vote on the agenda, the minutes. Having heard last week a rundown of the minutes and having received the minor editing of the minutes a few days ago, is there a motion to adopt the minutes?
So moved.
Thank you. Was that Marcia? Yeah, I think it was.
Yeah.
Thank you, Marcia. Is there a second?
Vanessa, second.
Thank you, Vanessa. Since we have a motion and a second, all in favor of adopting the minutes of May 9th, please say aye.
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 Thank you.
Aye. Aye.
Thank you. We have a uniform vote of aye from all present members. So those minutes are adopted. The next item on the agenda is hearing from our interim chief operating officer, if Michael Haas is here.
I am present.
Oh, good. Great. Welcome, Mr. Haas, and if you could share a few words with us on what's happening now in these terrible times of pandemics and budget shortages and that sort of thing.
Yeah, certainly challenging times. Thank you for having me. I'll give you just a brief background. I've been with the authority for just about 10 years now. I started as a construction engineer. I've worked both on the capital and operations side. I was senior vice president of rail, so overseeing the rail system, and recently stepped up in an interim measure as chief operating officer. So MTPD, rail, bus, and a lot of ancillary departments, all fall under the chief operating officer. Prior to joining WMATA, I was in construction. So I actually have a decent amount of experience with accessibility, and I've seen how the industry has changed and adapted, and many construction and engineering things I was involved with had to do with accessibility, whether it be ramps and landings and doors and hallway widths and everything else. I'm certainly well aware of a lot of the requirements, and glad to see that the industry has progressed in the fashion that it has, and has been able to leverage technology to improve the quality for all of our ridership. Mr. Blake and I met. I had to remind him, he didn't remember our first meeting, but years ago we were doing some work up at National Airport, and there's two platforms there, and we were concerned that those that would have trouble going down to the mezzanine level and then back up to cross the center track, where they normally, because of, we were only using one track, they wouldn't be able to do, or may not be able to do, what some of the other customers could do, which would be to go down to the mezzanine. So we actually parked a train on the center track to allow people to cross. And that ended up becoming an issue. And we actually built a bridge that we could quickly assemble and disassemble when we needed to bring a train or another piece of work equipment through. And Mr. Blake helped me through that process. We brought out members of the community to test the bridge to make sure it was good and had the right grip and had the right thresholds, for, wheelchairs and everything else. And I've always enjoyed working with Christian. So, these are certainly challenging times for the agency with the grounding of the 7000 series fleet. So we've not been able to put out the service that we would like to be able to put out for our ridership. It is, near and dear to all of us to provide the levels of service that are needed to prevent crowding, to allow for as much social distancing as we can. And I tell you, we are all working rigorously to bring that service back. We just got permission from the WMSC last week to start returning 7,000 series cars to the system. We should see them probably this week or next week back in passenger service on a very limited level. And then we'll be able to ramp up over the summer. So that's kind of the state of the system as it stands right now. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Yeah, Michael, you mentioned the status of the 7000 series with regards to the problems of wheels and axles. That's been a sore point for months now, and a lot of focus on it was made, I guess, in the past month. What about the recertification? Even more attention was given to that more recently. How's that coming along? Recertification of
Train operators? We have our full complement of train operators. We passed a temporary order that allowed for those that were within 1 year of their certification, which is more standard to FRA certification requirements, which is every 3 years. Our internal is every 2 years, but all these people are within 3 years of their certification. Out of the 200 plus that had lapsed in certification, we've pushed about 90 plus through already. So we're well ahead of schedule. We didn't publicly go out with a schedule that was too aggressive, just out of concerns we wouldn't be able to meet it, because we need the 7000 series cars to do the certificate or recertification. So that adds to the difficulty. But we were optimistic we'd be able to beat the schedule we originally put out. And so far in under a month, we've completed 90 of the recertifications, and all of our train operators, except for those on long-term leave, are within the 3 years of compliance.
So if within the past month, you've recertified 90 and there's around 200 total, you'll be done by maybe September, is that it?
Certainly by September.
Very good. Other members, do you have questions or comments for Michael?
Chair Calabia, this is Zenu. Phil Posner has his hand up. Dr. Posner, go ahead, please.
Yes, thank you. During the summer, there will be some changes as the 7,000 cars come back. So there will then be 8 car trains and 6 car trains, as we have now. And I know at one of the earlier board meetings, there was some discussion about not requiring, but suggesting that the last car be a mask car, a suggested mask car, not a required mask car, but suggesting people wearing masks use the last car of the train. And similarly for bicycles, particularly with the 6 car trains, which are going to become more crowded, suggesting that the bicycles use the last car. And it's already suggested that they use the doors at the end rather than the center door. But that's critical. But those are two thoughts and questions of how that's progressing, because I know it's been discussed but not been implemented yet.
I don't know if Christian has more details on that.
I don't at the moment. I know the AAC and we on the Metro Access side have continued to encourage drivers and customers to use their masks, to wear masks. I know we're continuing to distribute masks on fixed route services, but in terms of a designated car for mask wearing, I have not heard that move forward as of this time.
Thank you. It had been discussed, but I hadn't heard anything further about that. It was based on the quiet cars on Amtrak.
It makes sense.
Yes, it's a good idea.
I mean, it's a good suggestion. I just flew in and went up to Boston yesterday and was wearing a mask, you know, in the airport and on the airplane, and you know, it's a choice at this point, right?
Yes.
But you know, that's the choice that I made.
Well, actually, the advisory committee has formally recommended to WMATA that while they're no longer required, that mask wearing should be encouraged. And we've seen in the stations the electronic billboards, which have a variety of messages regarding masks. But with respect to buses, are there similar kind of ways that WMATA is encouraging the mask wearing? I know it's not required, but for example, on the ride on buses, they have on their flashing destination boards in the front of the bus, they have a message which does a good job of reminding people, encouraging them to wear masks. With respect to our buses, is there any such thing going on?
I don't believe so. The only thing we continue to do is provide masks. And right now we are providing about 30,000 masks per week on bus. And we are continuing to provide masks, in the hopes that people will use them. Obviously, they are, because we're going through, 30,000 per month. I can look to see, what improvements we could make to, signage. But I'd have to talk to the safety department about whether we can actually, go as far as recommending mask wearing.
And on the buses, which are subject to more of a risk of infection, Dallas and I believe Houston have been using germicidal filters for years prior even to the pandemic. Have we considered or are we piloting germicidal filters? We're piloting them on the trains. Are we doing the same thing on the buses?
I know that they improved the MERV quality of them. But the germicidal, I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, but I can certainly get back to you on that.
Yes. They're being piloted on our trains, and the trains are bigger and are less subject to infections, but the buses are compact and people are more crowded in them. So it's as urgent as in trains. And since it's being done in other systems, and maybe our new general manager will be familiar with it. But if you could look into any ideas that are being considered for having germicidal filters on the buses, we'd appreciate it.
Certainly.
Any other questions? I see that.
Here, Calabia, this is Anil. Steve Caffin has his hand up, followed by Doris Ray, and then Vanessa Coles at this time. So Steve, go ahead, please. You can unmute yourself. There you go.
Hi. Takes a second or two to push star six. I have a question regarding safety on the Metro Rail. And the question really relates to what some other systems, notably what we've read in New York City, are dealing with respect to increased crime and random attacks, random crime. And when I've ridden the Metro for many years, I myself have always looked to pick, especially after hours, a car that's more populated with people, and because there's safety in numbers. And, I'm wondering whether you might consider taking this concept after hours in designating perhaps a safety car or safety cars that persons could ride in the after rush hours in the later evening and perhaps certain times on Saturday and Sunday, that may be one car that's designated for safety purposes and might during certain periods even have some kind of roving police person monitoring those safety cars.
But I think it's an excellent idea. I mean, both those ideas about having special cars, I think, are very interesting ideas I hadn't heard of before. But there's an article that I have to read that Chief Gonzalo sent me about some of the tactics that they're using in New York City. So I'm hoping to get to the article tonight. He sent it to me late last week. One thing that may benefit that as well is if we could find a way to, introduce some type of, recording system in the 7,000 series cars. We do have the advantage of the camera systems, which I think, serves as both a deterrent and then also helps us, in the solving of any crimes. And without the camera systems in the legacy fleet, until we return the 7Ks, we don't have that advantage. We don't have that deterrent. And I think there was a behavioral shift in ridership when ridership was really low during the pandemic. I was out there. There were times I was the only person on the train. And so I think that that allowed people to, act in ways that they previously would not have acted because they were used, the system was much more crowded. But I think
right. But thank you very much. I think of a little more specifically that, it's kind of like see it, say it. People were not conscious of the possibility and the opportunity until that phrase came out, and all of a sudden we became conscious. And I know I look for the safest car after hours myself without even thinking about it. And many people, I think, do or don't. And so you have stragglers perhaps sitting in the very last car when they could easily be, you know what I'm talking about? So if there was one car designated with cameras and with the police, perhaps that would add to at least the appearance of and deterrence of possible criminal intent, if you will. Thank you very much. Yeah.
No, I appreciate it. Even if it's understood and there's a campaign based around that where people recognize that there is a higher probability of either, uniformed or plainclothes police on those specific cars, that might serve as a further deterrent. I mean, I think that's the main thing we're trying to do is deter crime, right? So I think it's a excellent idea. And, I certainly will bring it to the chief and to others to see if it's, something we could implement or in some fashion implement.
Doris?
Thank you. Right. Thanks very much. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Doris?
So, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So, I wanted to mention two things. One is with regard to you know, any idea of having a you know, one car that would be for people who are using masks. I'm wondering, and perhaps it's a matter of research, but I'm thinking that would be really, really hard to enforce and without getting entangled in maybe some civil rights laws issues. And for me, as a blind rider, I wouldn't be able to find which car that was anyway. Similarly, with the issue of you know, safety cars or cars that, you know, have Metro Police or whoever, you know, I see where the idea comes from, and in some ways I'd like to say it's good because a good idea because I certainly ridden from Vienna Station on through down to Arlington Courthouse in late evening, like last train coming down, and it is kind of, you really have to be very alert when you're on the train, and it's sometimes very hard to find a train car that has more people. And I mean, I can see whether there are people on it or not, but it's so sparsely ridden at that time of night that until you get maybe past East Falls Church, you're really not going to have that many people are anyway. And I think usually most of the crime that's been reported has been, you know, taken place either when a train was approaching its final destination station, or when people are sitting waiting to go. And the last thing I'll mention about that is that I also used to ride a lot for my job, which was in Silver Spring, back in town and then out into Virginia. And even at 8 o'clock at night, at one point there, it was kind of scary because we used to have panhandlers getting on the train. And one summer there was a lot of that, and then afterwards, news articles said that was a prelude to some, you know, crime that was committed against people's person on the red line from Silver Spring. So I don't really have any suggestions for how to deal with it, but I will say that as a blind person, I'm not sure that even if you designated something like that I could avail myself. And the question would be, for me as a rider, did something like that, then what would modest stance be if there was some crime committed against an individual, and the individual, you know, wanted to bring up some complaint or suit if something happens to them and their safety against WMATA, then would WMATA be saying, okay, you were supposed to be in the safe car? So those are the considerations that I think that we need thinking about if there's any serious consideration.
Thank you, Doris. I think Vanessa was next.
Yes, Vanessa, go ahead, please.
Okay.
Followed by Dr. Posner.
Okay. So I have a concern from consumers as well as some drivers. So just throwing a question out there. I'm hearing that the drivers are not wanting to do the sedans because of the closeness of the contact, and that a lot of them are going unused, And I have noticed that I'm getting more vans, which means I'm share riding more on my end. And so I'm wondering, can we offer masks in the sedan so maybe the drivers will feel more comfortable? Because I'm understanding they're not feeling comfortable with the sedan and they have an option. So a lot of them are choosing to do the van as opposed to the sedans.
Okay, Vanessa, just for clarification purposes, your comment is regarding metro access service.
Yes. I'll answer the question. Yes, that's a metro access question, not bus and rail. But I'll answer the question. I think it's a good question.
Well, that's true.
We have not been distributing. No problem. But Mr. Haas is in charge of all operations, and metro access is certainly one of them. So that's a fair question. In regards to the sedans, I'm hearing a little different. Actually, the most senior drivers actually like the sedans because they consider that easier work for the day. Now, are some drivers saying they only want to transport one passenger at a time? Yeah, there's a lot of that because no driver, quite frankly, in paratransit likes shared rides because it's just more work. But individuals get to pick their routes and they know they're picking a sedan route versus a van route. And the concept of shared rides is part of Metro Access. So that is just something the leadership of the companies, and we've dealt with this. I mean, this is not the first time the pandemic has added a little to it, which is why we made the adjustments even with the shared rides. Temporarily, we made some adjustments there, but drivers are responsible for performing their role as part of a shared ride, fixed route equivalent service. So we'll continue to work with that, but our focus continues to be customers wear your mask and ventilation. Ventilation has been our saving grace, and we're going to continue to move down that pathway. But we appreciate your question.
No, well, Is it possible to have a supply of the masks? I was really trying to...
Right, no, and that's what I say. We've been encouraging customers to wear their masks. The issue with distributing the masks, whereas on fixed route, you know, bus and rail, these are our employees, they're our facilities. For Metro, we would be giving the mask. We then have to get it back and... There's a lot of challenges there. There are a lot of hurdles we have to cross in dealing with the employees of another company and distributing masks. So we've just been encouraging our customers in terms of Metro Access to wear their masks. But if a customer doesn't want to wear a mask, we cannot force them to.
I
would not want to be in a situation where a driver has a supply of masks, decides to give the mask to a customer because he or she doesn't have it, and then wants to feel empowered that they can deny that trip or create a conflict because the customer will not wear the mask that is being provided. We don't want to get into that.
The drivers are not doing that. I was just, you had spoke on mask in fixed stations. So I was just trying to see if it was possible to do it on the sedans. No, they are not. They are not. To my knowledge, they are not asking people to put on masks. No.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Yeah. Right now, we're not distributing masks. We've talked about it in the committee as well, but Metro Access is a little different in that regard. So, yeah, we haven't been distributing masks, but we've been encouraging ventilation, and that's been you know our calling card since the pandemic.
I just bought it because some consumers asked me. Thank you.
Not a problem. Thank you.
Thank you, Vanessa. Dr. Posner, go ahead, please.
Yes, thank you. Just a quick comment on the safety issue and something that has been very effective with the airlines. Air marshals are plain clothes. So the bad guys don't know who is a policeman in the car with them. And the police chief might consider that, since individual rail cars are very similar to airplanes, to put a little doubt in the mind of the bad guys. Thank you.
I agree with the comment when you were talking about the safe car, you know, earlier in the conversation. You know, I think it's good to have plain clothes and uniform police, because then the criminals don't know, right, who's sitting there watching them. So I agree with you. I think it's a good tactic.
I think Barbara has her hand up. Barbara Millville.
Yes, thank you, Tino. This is Barbara. I was wondering if you might be able to comment on your plans for fare evasion issue. It seems like this is becoming more and more of an issue happening in greater frequency. I've been reading that the New York City subway system, it has reported approximately a third of the trips involved fare evasion. And it's really becoming a safety issue, because at the fare gates, you have people coming towards you trying to somehow get in, and then the tailgaters coming behind you, and they want to get in on your fare, so to speak. So could you address that, please?
So, and I've been working closely with the chief on this, and I think there will be a lot more to come in the next probably 60 days. It is enforced in Maryland and Virginia. It is not currently in DC. It is a heavy topic of discussion right now about how to address it. We share the same concerns that you share, and also just the overall profile of fare evaders. Oftentimes when they are arrested, they have multiple warrants and stuff like that. So it may not be people that should be riding the system. So there's that safety issue. We watched a video recently of people jumping the fare gates, and that can also be a safety issue for other customers and a safety issue for those who are doing the fare evading by hopping the gates, because it just kind of makes a rush at the gate. So it is something that we're very cognizant of. We are addressing. We're working closely with the DC government to make sure that we can take steps to stop that activity.
Yeah, I did ask the station manager about it, and they said that they the only thing they have is a flashlight, and they are relying on the transit police. And of course, the transit police cannot be everywhere. And I guess I would recommend a hefty fine, as they do in other countries. And that, it has to be enforced somehow, or why bother having the rule?
No, there has to be a deterrent. And it also, what we find is other people use the same tactics, the fare evasion tactics. Because if that person's not paying, why should I have to pay, right?
Yep, exactly.
Whether I have the money to afford the ride or not, if they're not paying, why should I pay? And the jurisdictions have frustrations that, in some areas it's taken greater advantage of than others, just because of the way that the laws are set up. So it's something that we're working with the board, the jurisdictions, DC government, and the police department on. So it is, a top priority for us. And we need the fare box to keep the trains running, right?
That's what I was just going to say. You could sure use it.
Oh yeah. Yeah. The one thing that we do get, a lot of students, I'm not saying the majority, but you'll see a lot of students, especially DC public schools, because of the enforcement practices in DC, will jump the fence. Jump the fare gates, but they are part of the Kids Ride Free program. And we do still collect, even though they're not tapping, we do still collect those funds because it's based on a ratio. But we are also trying to do, you know, thinking about education campaigns at the school level to try and get them. And a lot of times it's they've lost the card, they can't find the card, you know, those types of issues. I have children, I understand, but you know, it is something that we're talking about doing campaigns within the schools because they'll listen to their teachers, they'll listen to their friends, they won't listen to their parents. So we're looking at those types of tactics to you know, address the youth and other tactics to, you know, address the rest of the population.
Denise, Doris has had a chance, Steve has had a chance, Denise has not, yeah. And we're already into the next agenda item. So Denise, if you could quickly make your statement or question.
I'm sorry. Go on.
Denise?
Who's supposed to go first?
Ms. Rush, go ahead.
Okay. This is Ms. Rush. And I want to know, is there a way that they, when they touch to jump, to hop the fence, that triggers a picture so you can see the consistent, the liquid payers? Or, like when you rob the money at the bank, and you get down the road, it puts ink all over you. Something that will keep them from doing it.
Mike?
If they hop the fence, could the cameras can't? That automatically sets off the camera and takes a picture of the person some kind of way. Or if they touch that and hop over, they get sprayed with ink. I don't care what they do, but something. Is there something we can do?
I think we'd have a hard time getting, you know, it approved to, you know, shoot people with ink for jumping the fair gates. I mean, very interesting, you know, proposition, but would be tough to do. But like I said, I recently watched a video because there was a presentation about this. We're looking at this very closely. And it was person after person hopping the fair gate. And you know, I witnessed it myself, just watching the video. So the new fair gates do alarm. And so that, and there are, the alarms are much more smarter than on the old fair gates, where there was, I think, 2 sensors. The new fair gates have 18 sensors. They also, the way that they come together, they have a higher arc. So you have to jump even higher, but, you know, certainly, you know, a lot of people are able to still jump over the fair gates, but it does trigger an alarm. They are captured on video. I think that the biggest issue that we're facing right now is how we enforce it in DC. And that's what we're working through right now with the DC government. And I think there'll be a lot of changes in the next few months.
It is 4:43 and we're already into the time for the next guests and presentation on Waymap. Thank you, Michael. We really appreciate it. And good luck on the various things you're looking into. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Anna. I'll get back with Christian on the few points that I got notes on.
Okay.
Thank you.
We now have a follow-up discussion on Waymap. Is Tom Pei and Zankar?
Chair Calabria, this is, I know we have Paul Burton from Waymap as well as Shankar Sevak, and they will be presenting their presentation.
Okay. Yes, Zankar or whoever.
Yeah. Hello, everyone. Yes, Tom sends his apologies, but I have my colleague here with me, Paul. I think he's a local Washington, D.C. resident. I'm dialing in from the United Kingdom, and I can take you through presentation slides, which will talk about, you know, what we did during the trial, some of the feedbacks and our plans moving forwards. So if you can go to the next slide, please, Anu.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It is so,
yeah, so this slide is basically providing the summary of the recent trial that we concluded in Washington, D.C. Again, the purpose was to give our trialists and observers a flavor of WAMAP system in a very small way. An example where you can try a small segment of a journey near the train stations and around that. So I think that was the whole purpose. And we wanted to collect a lot of feedback as well so that we can go back and implement, real user perspective into our future products. So again, the trial was done at two metro stations, Silver Spring and Braddock Road, and also incorporated adjacent bus stops. In total, we had 15 vision impaired participants. We had seven sighted users, mainly from WMATA staff. And we also had three O&M instructors as well. And during this 2 weeks trial, we collected wealth of feedback. Some of us are comparing that to gold dust. So I think as you can imagine, it was very valuable, the experience for WMAP team, as well as I'm sure for the trialist and some of the observers as well. It was an important milestone. And again, as I mentioned, we collected very valuable feedback, which is now currently being reviewed in very detail and going through some change processes. So going to the next slide, where-
Zankar, what does O&M stand for?
It's a short form of orientation and mobility instructors.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. So again, from the feedback, some of the things that have been highlighted, which are the key takeaways we are focusing on. The first and foremost is the relevance and effectiveness of the audio instructions. Relevance comes with the type of users and, you know, their preferences in terms of, you know, how they want to listen, how they walk, et cetera, et cetera. The second most important item came across was the safety of the users and the cautions, especially around the platform and the crossings. The third item was the application resiliency in key areas, such as through fare gates, escalators, elevators, et cetera, especially when there were delays or mishaps, users losing their card, the card's not working, had to wait for unreasonable time because of the rush hour around elevators and dysfunctional escalators when they were going through some repairs. So things like that where we found a scope of improving the resiliency of the application. The usability of the application came out as well in terms of the user interface and how users can interact with that. Different users have different requirements, different preferences, whether they want to use voiceover or whether they want to use a magnifying glass or a magnifying functionality, a zoom level within the mobile phone. So again, I think that is something we are reviewing. And there are some other areas as well, such as continuous engagement with the users, supporting path diversions and providing dynamic rerouting when they were diverging from their original intended paths or routes. Some requested about the exploration. So they wanted to know more than their usual journeys, like nearby businesses, landmarks, coffee places, et cetera, et cetera. And the last item was about the user support in terms of where to get help if they needed some support regarding the application usage or wayfinding at a particular venue. So I think very useful feedback, very strong takeaways, I think the application and the service will be better for it once we make necessary changes. So yeah, again, I would like to thank WMATA for the support, you know, inviting users and also giving us useful feedback during that time. So if you can now go to the next slide, Anu. So what are we doing now then? We pledged that we will have a regular engagement with various stakeholders, users, community before September comprehensive pilot. And that's what we are continuing to do. And as a result, we are here sharing our plans and ideas and other things. We are just in the process of scheduling our next set of internal tests, which are going to happen in July. And we will be trialing a complete system this time, not just a segment of a wayfinding journey. So here we are talking about door-to-door wayfinding, covering both outdoor and indoor areas. So basically, we will have an area where we can go from a residential building to a business using a combination of train and bus transport. Meanwhile, we are continuously working on generating more data. There are lots of stations to go through, working very closely with Carol and the team. We are doing the product development through the improvements and the changes, and we are also improving our quality, implementing some reasonable quality control measures. So once we have gone through the July test, internal test, we will then deploy the full system in August. In respect to launching a formal pilot in late September. Again, September comprehensive pilot will have approximately 25 train stations, number of full bus routes, significant number of bus stops, and relevant outdoor data.
Sankar, there are about 90 rail stations at the moment, excluding the ones that go out to Dulles. You've done 25 of the 90 or so?
No, that is the plan to finish by September.
And then after the 25 are done in September, the remaining number, and there are a total of, again, about 90. When do you anticipate the completion of all stations?
In the following 6 months. So in addition to doing all these things, we are also building our scaling capacity by, you know, putting proper processes in, and as well as increasing our mapping team. So by September, we will have a full-fledged clockwork kind of map generation and testing. At the same time, we have a much larger team as well. So we anticipate to finish the rest of the network in the following 6 months. So by the end of quarter one, just before the summer, we hope to have, you know, all 90 or 100 stations completed.
Okay. And with respect to the buses, I guess you're doing bus bays around the train stations or bus stops, but there are, I don't know how many bus routes there are, maybe 250 or so. The coverage of those in the next year or so, or what?
Yeah, most likely to be. So I think, according to my calculation, and I think these numbers vary largely depending on which information you find. So I think according to our calculations, there are 186 routes from WMATA, and I think there are partners as well. So most likely we will have a partial collection of these routes for the September trial. And then to have a full-fledged bus services, I think it will take approximately another 9 to 12 months thereafter. But I have a slide to talk about bus routes and how we are planning to okay. generate and implement those.
Sure, proceed. Yes.
Yes. Okay. So if you can move to the next slide, please. There were a few questions about the wheelchair. So just a quick slide to explain what we are doing in terms of wheelchairs. So for wheelchairs to work, we have a dedicated hardware device. We call it Pod, which is kind of a very small wireless device, a size of a medium-sized coin, which you can clip onto a wheelchair spoke. So we have been testing rigorously recently. We had done some tests at Washington DC stations as well with wheelchair and Pod. We had some issues related to connectivity between the Pod and the mobile phone. So we have been working tirelessly to fix those issues. And we have fixed those issues. So now at the moment, we are just going through again a very extensive test to make sure that the rest of the systems are working and the Pod and the wheelchair are performing as expected. So significant progress there in terms of wheelchairs. And wheelchairs will be part of the September trial.
Okay.
So moving on to the next slide, which is a kind of a map showing the station maps and the stations that are going to be part of the September trial. So we have started with Montgomery County with Silver Spring Station in the north. So we are going to extend that zone to support another 8 stations around that Silver Spring between yellow and green line and I think Green Belt Station to the connection stations at Fort Totten and then on the red line moving as far as Union Station. At the moment, we have a limitation in terms of providing service at the overground stations only. So I think that has been a significant factor in coming out with potential stations for this September pilot. Similarly, we had another zone near Vienna, then moving towards DC as far as East Fall Church Station and then going slightly north to the rest and east on the Silver Line. So that's another zone of 8 to 9 stations that is going to be part of this trial. Originally, we also had another cluster at South Virginia near Braddock Road stations covering Reagan Airport in the north and going to the south of the Yellow Line at Huntingdon. But we have just learned that there has been some repair work going on or will be going on during the September-October timeframe, and these stations are likely to be unavailable. And as a result of that, we have made some changes in the plan. So instead of doing the south line yellow in Virginia, we are going to go with a blue line where we will have a cluster around the Largo Town Center going as far as Banning Road. So again, a small cluster of 4 stations covering the blue and the silver line. So these are going to be the zones, the stations in total. I think there are about 24 stations part of the September trial. And if you can now move on.
Can I just ask, for instance, Judiciary Square and L'Enfant Plaza, Federal Triangle, they are not included yet, right? And they're not, when do you anticipate the downtown station?
So we have just started discussion about getting clearance from, you know, whatever the authority is. So I think that process is underway now. So I think as soon as we get the clearance to go underground, which requires a slightly more involved mapping work because it needs LiDAR scanning, involves third party access as well. So I think there's some process to go through, which is likely to take probably a few months, but we are hoping to start underground station scanning work from August, September timeframe.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Proceed.
Yeah. So, I mean, the present slide is just a kind of a tabular form of the list of the stations that I just mentioned. If anyone wants a detail, you can dive into it, or I'm happy to answer if you have any specific inquiry about particular station. Otherwise, we can move on to the next slide about the bus routes. So again, we are currently reviewing what bus routes to come up with. I think WMATA will be consulted and involved in the process as well. So we will make sure that similar to train stations, we are equally going through similar process and coming back with a reasonable set of bus routes, which then can provide a very thorough door-to-door experience for a potential trialist. So next slide just talks about some of the requirements or some of the factors that we are going to consider while coming up with potential bus routes. The fundamental criteria here from the WMAP side is to make sure that whatever bus routes we pick are complete in terms of their service end-to-end. These bus routes will be connected to one or more selected stations that we just went over. And similar to train stations, the bus routes will also be selected from three different zones. So, you know, the north, the west, and probably the southeast as well. Each bus route will support 1 kilometer street area around it for the full bus route length. So this is kind of the physical restriction or geographical restrictions we will have for the September pilot, given the huge amount of outdoor data required to provide this door-to-door service. But we believe that this 1 kilometer width around any bus route will probably cover two blocks and walking distance up to 20 minutes. So hopefully that will cover most of our potential users for this trial. But again, we are more than happy to hear from WMATA, and if they have any other feedback, then we will consider that and change our plan. The street data will include bus stops, sidewalks, crossings, house addresses, points of interest, including landmarks and businesses for door-to-door navigation. So users will be able to start from their resident and then they can go to a library or a museum or a coffee shop using either a metro or a bus or both. So that is the vision and plan for the September comprehensive pilot. So that's the end of the slide. We will take any questions.
Questions? I'll start. Given all the work to be done, will all the train stations and bus stops, is it fair to say that the mapping will be done, say, within 5 years?
No, I think we are hoping that most of the mapping will be completed before the end of 2023. I think certainly for train stations, we hope to map them before around March, April time next year. I think the bus routes will be mapped around this I think probably around August, September time next year, and the rest of the outdoor coverage will be available soon after as well. So no, I think it would be much faster than that.
In terms of buses, there must be 10,000 bus stops. Do you mean each bus stop will be mapped out, house addresses, stores, and that sort of thing?
Yes, that's the plan, yes.
Well, I hope you're right.
we do get help from WMATA because they already have significant data about the outdoors. So a lot of bus stops are just a single poles with some shelter. So mapping wise, we don't have to do too much work except verifying the location of these points on map.
Well, I'm just guessing, but I bet you there are 10,000 bus stops. Any other? Let's see. We have a question from Patrick and Doris. Mm-hmm. And then Barbara.
And in the interest of time, just to stay on schedule, we will have 3 minutes for each participant. So when you start speaking, your time will begin. Go ahead, Patrick.
Even me, huh? Okay. Congratulations on this project. The schedule, I think, is a little more aggressive than I expected. I'm not complaining about that. I thought it was going to take longer to do the mapping of the stations, but I like the schedule I just heard that you just gave to Tino. That's good. So good for that. And then I think the other part of my question just jumped out of my head. I assume you're going to want a lot of participation from us for the September rollout, correct? From the disability community.
Yes, as many as possible. And I mean, this trial was supervised trial. So we had our team guiding users, but this September comprehensive pilot will be independent. All the trialists will be able to download the applications from respective stores. Right. We have, you know, user guides and training facilities in Washington, D.C. area as well. So
yeah, so we will get all instructions on how to do that if you're going to be a participant in this study, right?
Yes.
September. Beautiful. Okay, we'll get the word out.
Thank Doris, you, Patrick.
Doris, thank you.
Doris, keep it short. Doris?
Yes. Hi, this is Doris Ray. So I think I heard that you're going to be doing Vienna Station and the stations between Vienna and East Falls Church, yes?
Yes, correct.
And that's in July or September?
That's for September.
And I think that's great. I think real big advantage to Vienna and in particular West Falls Church is all the bus stops that are there, and I'm hoping that you're going to do both sides of each station, but because that will help people sooner, as I understand at some point, maybe September, that federal government might be starting to have people come back into the office. Mm-hmm. The other thing I was curious about is whether at those localities and the other stations you will be mapping the route from the station entrances to the taxi stands, which is often very important. I was thinking about that actually when you were doing Braddock Road, and certainly it would be helpful at King Street. So I'm wondering whether one of the things that you're going to be mapping is the route to the taxi stands.
Yes, yes, they are part of the plan. All the important landmarks, such as taxi stands, Uber drop-off collection, et cetera, will be part of that.
Yeah, like so at West Falls Church, they're in two places, and you know both sides of the station are the same in Vienna, separate.
Yeah.
Environment isn't entirely separate. So when you're doing West Falls Church, are you going to do the lower level where the connector and the Loudoun buses are coming in?
Yes.
Oh, great. Oh, this is wonderful. Yes, I agree with Patrick. This is just wonderful. Thank you. The Independent Center of Northern Virginia would be happy to get the word out about needing
help. Brilliant.
Barbara, yeah. Millville.
Thank you, Doris.
Yes, hi. This is Barbara. Good to see you. And I was wondering, for the final rollout, would the 1K limit still be applicable?
Not the final rollout. So the final rollout will have Washington, D.C. and all counties fully mapped. I don't see this restriction being applied to the final rollout.
So am I understanding correctly that if somebody wants to walk 2K to their destination, that this tool would assist them?
Yes.
Perfect. Thank you.
You're welcome.
There are no other hands up. So thank you, Zankar. Good luck on your timetable. We look forward to implementation of the WayMap program.
Yeah, thank you. We need all the luck we can get. So thank you very much.
Sure, Calabia, this is Anu. Patrick, did you just raise your hand up or?
He hasn't put it down.
Yes, I did. A very quick question.
Sure.
In describing the bus stops and jumping over
to your policy.
Next presentation.
Area.
I'm sorry.
Transit.
Go ahead, Patrick.
Authority.
I'm sorry. Am I?
Go ahead, Patrick.
Thank you, Tino and Anu. Just sort of going into the next presentation, I'm wondering, I don't have an answer. Floating bus stops. It'll be interesting to see how we describe those, but announcing that we will have an upcoming floating bus stop in a certain location might be an interesting challenge for this technology. For some of us.
For sure.
Just a thought, yeah.
That was that card, do you want to attempt an answer on that?
I think it was mentioned by one of the trialists. Floating bus stop. I think it was one near Silver Spring, I think, yes.
Yeah, Sue Crawford, by the way, yeah.
Yeah, okay, yeah. So yeah. I think We need to see what WMATA is doing about that, and I think depending on their policy, I think we will make sure that the way it's implemented in the system has
exactly yeah it's just something to be aware of. Actually, our next presentation might answer some of those questions, but thank you for that. Something to you don't want everything to be easy, right?
Exactly.
This is Anu and Shankar, just for your information, just like Patrick said, we do have a discussion about the floating bus stop right afterwards.
Now, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, no, that's fine. I'll stick around and learn about it. So
thank you. Melissa, could you introduce yourself?
Well, thank you, Shankar.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for having me this afternoon. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you and hear some of your comments. The project that Zankar just talked about is really interesting, and it would be a good opportunity to provide some bus stop characteristics along with the program. So I'm Melissa Anderson, and I work for the Department of Transportation, Federal Highway Administration, in the Office of Civil Rights. And our office addresses complaints that are sent in. And we also work with other program agents or other programs that do pedestrian bicycle design and application and policy to make sure they take into consideration people who have disabilities. In the past, I've worked for Federal Highway for close to 2 years now. And prior to that, I was a consultant I worked with local agencies, and I represent people with disabilities in different capacities. Prior to that, I worked for state DOT and oversaw the statewide pedestrian and bicycle program and making sure that things were accessible and help them with their ADA transition plan to remove barriers. So I'm here to provide a little bit of information, but I'm really interested in hearing what your subcommittee has to say about floating bus stops. And my ADA team leader is in the audience today. So I just wanted to let you know, her name is Sharon Field. So she's listening too, to hear all the things that you guys have to say.
Sharon Field.
Yes.
Thank you.
So right now, floating bus stops are becoming popular across the country. And, you know, we're aware of that. They've been kind of sneaking up on us for several years now. When we do, we are charged with enforcement of both the Americans with Disabilities Act and Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act. And both of those prohibit discrimination against people who have disabilities. Our office, typically we work on issues that happen in the public right-of-way. So sidewalks, curb ramps, you know, pedestrian push buttons and parking. FTA generally works on the bus stops themselves. So we have to kind of partner to address issues when they come up. When we investigate a complaint, we have to have a standard to say, yes, you've complied with that standard, or no, you haven't. And currently, there isn't an enforceable standard in the public right-of-way. It's been in the works for many, many years. There's a long rulemaking process to get it done, and we're hoping that we can make it a standard in the next year or so. So the U.S. Access Board has to publish it as a guideline, and then the DOT and the Department of Justice have to adopt it for it to become a standard. And when we go through our rulemaking process at Federal Highway, it's going to be available for public comment. So you might keep an eye out for that, and you'll have an opportunity to look at the proposed guideline and let us know what you think about it. If you see things that you think are a problem, if you have suggestions for making them better. But right now, when we do enforcement, we have to do it based on the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Rehabilitation Act requirement that facilities be accessible to and usable by people who have disabilities. So that's the standard that we hold agencies to. Now, with regards to floating bus stops, we know they're out there. We know that they cause an issue for people with vision disabilities. Because there's not a standard, we don't have anything that specifically addresses them. When they're well designed, they can work pretty well. We know that there are concerns about knowing where the stop is, and then conflicts with bikes, because a lot of times that bus stop is floating because you've put a bike lane between where the bus is going to pick up the passengers and the sidewalk where the passengers get to the bus. And for someone with a vision disability or someone who is completely blind, you know, it's hard to locate the bus stop. It's hard to hear the bicyclists. And although bicyclists are supposed to yield to pedestrians, we all know that is not always what happens in reality, which for me is an irritation, but for somebody who can't see them coming, I mean, they don't make any noise, they can be traveling pretty quickly, it's a safety issue. So we're aware of that. So it's hard to know. I know that for for people who can't see a bike coming, it's hard to know if and when the bike is there and if and when they have stopped. Some of the things they're doing right now are some of the ways that they design these to make them more usable by all pedestrians, wheelchair users, able-bodied people, people with vision disabilities, is they've made like a raised crosswalk between the sidewalk and the floating island, because the floating island is usually raised up on a curb at the same level of the sidewalk, but the bike lane is at street level. And so the crosswalk between the sidewalk and the floating island is typically it's raised. And there are signs and different pavement markings that are required to alert bicyclists to yield to pedestrians. And different states have different policies, and I can't honestly say that they work for vehicles yielding to pedestrians. Some states have laws that say you have to stop for a pedestrian. Some say you just have to yield for a pedestrian. It shouldn't make any difference. Bicyclists have to give pedestrians the right of way when they're crossing. You'll see with the floating bus stops that detectable warnings are used, just like at a street, because bike lanes are vehicle lanes, because a bike is considered a vehicle. The detectable warnings let a person know that they're about to step into a vehicle lane. So the detectable warnings, that's what we call them, but they're the bumpy things at the bottom of a curb ramp. And when they're installed properly, they let you know that this is where you can cross to get to that floating bus stop. And then there's also some research going on at a national level, and some cities have done this anyway. And that research involves tactile guide strips. So the tactile guide strips would potentially go across the width of the sidewalk to let you know that there's something of interest. If you can't see that there's a bus stop or a mid-block crossing, that guide strip would let you know that there's something there. And if you know you're looking for a bus stop and it's in this general area, you would know that guide strip is probably an indication of where that bus stop is. So the research that's going on now will identify the shapes and designs of the tactile guide strips. And it's also going to try to provide information on where the best location and the best layout for those are, so that they're most effective for people who have vision disabilities, and so that they don't get in the way too much of people who are wheelchair users. And there are some cities that are already doing this, and they're doing it kind of on an experimental basis to see what works, because they're not waiting on us, which is fine, because that gives us a good opportunity in our research to see how it's working in the field. We're aware of the issues that some people are facing with floating bus stops. And there are also some areas that we've noticed come up recently that I guess are more concerning to us. And I've seen some of them in the DC area, and that's where the bike lane is right next to the curb, and they have a raised crossing at the bus stop so that the bus can't pull clear to the curb to pick up passengers. And that is it creates a conflict if you're getting ready to get on the bus or get off the bus, you're doing it directly from that bike lane. And you're less likely, you're going to be waiting in the bike lane. If people are standing there, it's more likely that bicyclists will stop. But you also have the concerns about when the bus lowers a ramp or a lift onto the bike lane, that you know, they may catch a bicyclist who's doesn't see a pedestrian crossing and chooses to go through that crosswalk pretty quickly to avoid the pedestrians. And, you know, they may run into a conflict with the ramps or the lifts. So those are things we're seeing happening too. And, you know, we're watching. We don't have any real, I guess, authority to step in and say, don't do that. I mean, I'm a professional engineer, and it's my responsibility. If I'm a designer, it's my responsibility to do good design. And people can give me all the rules, but it's up to me to figure out how to use those to keep people safe and to provide access to different facilities. So even though you give people everything they need to make good decisions, it doesn't always happen. Each project is usually a little bit different, and you'll come up with different solutions for each area. So that's something else that we see that I know causes problems for people who can't see what's going on around them is sometimes there's a lack of consistency. And so, you know, there's a bus stop there, but if it's not an area you're familiar with, it's not around your home, let's say you're going to the doctor's appointment or a different grocery store, and you're not familiar with it, it may be set up a little bit differently than the floating bus stops that you're used to seeing. So that being said, if you have issues with floating bus stops, I mean, we're interested and we're watching from a policy standpoint, and we're voicing our concerns, but we can't, right now we're not willing to tell people, or we can't really tell people you can't do that. So floating bus stops are not necessarily a bad idea when they're designed well, and people who have disabilities are taken into account during that design process. It's a little more inconvenient for some people, but as more people start to walk and start to bike, we all have to work together to share the limited right-of-way space that we have. So that's the, you know, that's the reason things are coming up the way they are. And if you have problems and things don't feel accessible to and usable by a person who has a disability, you are welcome to file a complaint with our office. If you can go to Federal Highway's website and look up the Office of Civil Rights and find it. Or you can just go to the internet and say how to file an ADA complaint with FHWA, and you'll find our website. So it's an online complaint form. I'll admit we have a lot of complaints because we deal with the entire country. So you can always file a complaint. That's absolutely your right. It does take us some time to investigate and process all of the complaints. So I always used to, before I worked for Federal Highway, encourage people to work with their local agencies, work with the transit agency to try to address concerns and issues before getting as far as filing a federal complaint.
Melissa, our committee has been worried about these matters for a good 2 years. Patrick Sheehan of Montgomery County has been our lead spokesperson. We are developing a team to deal with the kinds of problems that people with disabilities and seniors encounter when they come across floating bus stops and bike lanes in particular.
Right.
We hope to have a presentation made, and maybe we'll even be able to do our first test of the presentation next month with our District of Columbia counterpart. We generally have time for members to raise questions. Patrick, I'm sure you must have some questions. I don't know where we'll even start, but I must admit, if I were to unleash our members on you regarding this topic, you would need a shield to protect yourself. I see that Doris, please quickly your question. And then Patrick, I know Philippa is concerned about these matters and Thomas Mangrum. So Doris, go.
Thank you for coming, and I'm glad to hear about the pedestrian rights of way standards, and we'll look forward to that. And I'm hoping perhaps that I might talk to you, we might talk to you about coming to our various jurisdictions. So I live and work in Northern Virginia and work for the Center for Independent Living in. And we in Arlington County, our Disability Advisory Commission is very concerned about this and really like to be able to talk with you as well, because
could you give some
floating
specific,
bus stops are going up there.
Doris,
yeah, okay, so, but the, I mean, it's not, but the question that I have is well, actually, it's a comment, Mr. Chair, which is we need to know what we can do to slow down the development of these and consider also the relationship to the bike lanes, which are also lanes for electronic bikes and scooters, and they are preventing people even from doing things like being able to safely go out to a curb and have to go through a bike lane to get a taxi cab, so, or a paratransit vehicle. So I'm hoping that we can talk to you about that and the things that the state of Virginia is doing to undermine the guidelines from the Access Board regarding traffic signals, accessible traffic signals.
Patrick, you have your hand up, and then Thomas.
Thank you, Tina.
Yes, Patrick.
Thank you. Melissa, thank you so much for presenting to us this evening. I've been working with Sue Crawford. I think you probably know Sue. And we've been working in Montgomery County on this issue. I think to boil it down for visually impaired, one of the things that is most that we have to keep in mind here is maintaining effective communication. As taking the bus stop off the sidewalk and putting it in the middle of the street, if you don't have something that's verbally going to tell you and also tell your bicyclist to stop as you're crossing the street, you haven't maintained that effective communication. In Montgomery County, we've been working with them for, 4 years now. And they have agreed that before they install any new floating bus stops, what they want to put on the corner there where the bus stop is an accessible pedestrian-like signal, so that it's ticking, so that you know that you have something there. As a visually impaired person, blind person, you will hear the ticking. You can push the button in and it will announce to you that you have a floating bus stop that is, 5 feet away. And then as you push that in, it will also turn on a red light to indicate to the bicyclist coming down that the light is on, so you can cross over to the floating bus stop. But it would be an audible message so that, you'd be able to hear that. And then also you could have a vibral tactile indicator for someone who is deafblind with the same type of information. You've hit a lot of the good points. For instance, we've talked to WMATA about this because uniformity is key. In Montgomery County, we have 5 installations of floating bus stops and they're set up 5 different ways. They install them and then they realize, oh, we forgot this. Oh, we forgot that. So they want to put a site together to get feedback before they go installing that. And that's what we're trying to do throughout the entire region, Virginia, DC, and Maryland, to have one type of uniform installation of the floating bus stop. And so we now have them working with us, and that's good. That would be Matt Johnson in Montgomery County here, Department of Planning.
Yes, Melissa, do you have a response?
No, we would love to hear from you guys. And Doris, you can contact me. Anu has my contact information, and we can talk about your concerns. And yeah, consistency would be, and uniformity mm-hmm. would be really helpful. So good. It's great that if you guys can get a regional team, and
that's what we're working on.
Yeah, and then we can get feedback too as you guys are working, because I know that we work with the different, we get involved sometimes in review of what's going on, not from a compliance standpoint, but just from a research type standpoint.
Philippa, and then Thomas, and then Steve. Philippa?
Okay, hi everyone. Yes, I've made it quite clear how I feel about those floating bus stops. I wish they would just float on somewhere, but as long as they are here to stay. But I'm just wondering, is there any way, I mean, you may not be the appropriate person, but some way to put sound on these scooters and bikes, at least the ones that are, you know, in the racks that the companies put there? Because it's like all of a sudden something's up on top of you and you never saw it coming or heard it coming. It's either zooming from behind you and moving around you like you're like they're the ball on the pinball machine. So I'm just wondering, who would we speak with about that? That's just something I'd like to see considered, some sound on those things so they can't sneak up on you, at least if you, because I know they're going to keep doing those floating bus things, those floating bus death traps. But
I am not the person who
can
get change, and I'm not sure that it would necessarily come through DOT. I don't know who, Congress or someone, made vehicles be required to make sound, some of the electric vehicles that were a problem for people. I will keep that in mind in my conversations with different program offices. But I'm not sure that our office is actually.
Right. No, I know it's not your office. It would require a law probably, or some kind of conversation with the manufacturers of those bikes and scooters.
And you can always contact manufacturers and make a recommendation, because if they end up in litigation for some reason, you know, you can do a lot of preventative medicine for the cost of lawsuits. So contact them directly, perhaps.
Okay. Thomas, and then Steve. Thomas, you're muted.
Yes, that's all. I hear you. This is Thomas. When it comes to the floating bus stops and stuff, it got to be a point where the buses know where to let you on at the floating bus stop. Because, like, when the ramp comes down, if the bus is trying to let you on, and there's benches right there, that space is taking up space for the wheelchair to actually get on or off the bus. And also, I know this might not have nothing to do with the floating bus stops directly, but at the floating bus stops, it should be people that they see potholes leading to the floating bus stop or what have you, that y'all call 311 to report it or what have you, or Department of Public Works, so they can like repair it. Because there's some bus stops, whether or not they're floating or not, that you can't really get to if you're a wheelchair user. You'll trip and fall. And if you're blind, you can trip and fall. So that should be a concern. But like I said, it got to be a place that's marked out for the buses, bus drivers, so they'll know what part of the floating bus stop can you let people off and can you let people on? Thank you.
Steve, you're muted, Steve.
Hi, Steve Kaplan. Melissa, quick question. Is there a, you know, doubtless there have been many questions and many issues and many and some solutions that various cities and municipalities have raised and also have developed. Is there a central repository, perhaps with yourself or one which you might create, where as cities are dealing with this issue, there's a resource that they can go to see how, you know, how situations can be practically resolved without perhaps each city trying to create its own approach and dealing with its own issues and problems?
It wouldn't be our office. We have an Office of Environment and Planning, and they actually do a lot of the pedestrian and bicycle research and interaction with the local agencies. The Transportation Research Board is a place where, I mean, they sponsor a lot of research that's funded by state DOTs and local agencies. And their research is centralized, but I agree it would be a wonderful idea. It would be wonderful if I could push a button and find out what everybody's doing all over the country on a whole bunch of issues, but to be honest with you, I don't know how we could make that happen.
Well, you know, one approach may be just to publicize that there is a central resource and invite the municipalities and cities as they're working to implement and working to resolve issues and problems to share their results. Such that eventually there's kind of a universe of possibilities to go to without having to reinvent each time an approach that should work but may not work.
Well, and the Transportation Research Board and Federal Highway, sometimes we do like a synthesis project where we identify best practices across the country, and you know it becomes a point in time we can. You know, we can pull a bunch of states or a bunch of cities where we know that some of these are happening and provide, you know, a point in time guidebook or handbook on best practices or current implementation practices. And I can bring that up to our environmental staff. It wouldn't be through our office, but it might come through our bike ped group. I'll bring that up. Good idea, Steve.
So there is a Transportation Research Board, and they are privy to some of the things that are going on in scattered fashion around the country.
Right.
Do you have the a way of someone we can contact there?
So it's just, it's trb.org, but their research is initiated typically by they can be initiated just ideas for research. And then state DOT members typically pick the projects that they want to research. So having someone call up and say, hey, you need to research this is, it wouldn't be working within the system that they have set up. Working with someone at Federal Highway to let them know that there's a need might give us an opportunity to approach TRB, because we sometimes submit proposals for research and sometimes they get picked and sometimes they don't.
But at the moment, there's no handbook or guide to best practices that anyone has collected, the research.
You know?
Yes.
This is Pat again. I know that with American Council of the Blind, that I'm a member of, they have a pedestrian environmental access committee. And this is one of the initiatives that we're collecting. So as a disability organization, because we have skin in the game, this is important to us. And so we're looking at this right now. So this would be great, Melissa, to be able to have a best practice synthesis, you know, asked for by an organization like yours. Right. And that would be great. The when we have been working with Montgomery County, Matt Johnson with Tool Design, when they did a study, what they basically found, Tino, was that there isn't really much out there right now. I mean, I think this area might be able to set a trend, particularly if we can put things in place over a region, which will enforce things like effective communication and that sort of thing. I know that they said in Chicago, they just put them out there, that's it. All of a sudden your bus stop that was on the corner, on the sidewalk, is now in the middle of the street. And right. No guide ramps, no, barely any truncated domes. I don't even think they have that, but no, you know, the blind person walking says, where'd my bus stop go? No idea, it's been moved out to the first lane of traffic, you know. So you're right, Tino. There isn't a lot out there, but I think you start highlighting what is best practices, because you've got a lot of different types of signals that can supply you the information, you know, specialized pedestrian, you know, signals that are pedestrian activated and all that sort of thing. It can get fairly sophisticated and complicated, but the important thing is that you do the work up front and test it out before you install these things. And, you know, Montgomery County certainly has made mistakes, but to their credit, they have, they've realized that, and now they want to make things right, and that's good. So we're learning, and then we pass the knowledge on to the rest of the region. That would be great.
I know that the city of Portland is also doing some test sites, yes, for floating bus stops.
Right. Yes.
Portland, Oregon. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. They're always out front. They're great. What a great place. Yeah.
One of the things, though, is that, I guess if we canvass people, we'd come up with a handbook of worst practices. For example, you know, these bike lanes that are now two ways. That means that a person has to look this way and then that way and then this way and that way to make sure that they are clear of any traffic. And the bikes are silent, all of us know and have seen bikers go through red lights or stop signs and ride on sidewalks. You know, when we talk to bicyclist associations, we're talking to people who are potentially sympathetic to our needs. But there are these random folks out there who are a danger to us. And if you're building these bike lanes, either one way or two ways at the same time, some of these bikers are gonna, you know, it just enhances their ability to do the wrong thing.
Right.
Could you give us your email address, please?
Chair Calabia, I would be happy to share the contact information for Melissa Anderson.
Okay, with all of us, yes, please.
Yes.
Please do.
Okay.
You
have some public comments.
Well, we also have hands up. I don't know if there are hands up that haven't been put down, but Vanessa?
True. But just to alert you, we do have some public comments by Dr. Posner as well. So.
Okay.
I just wanted to make a quick comment regarding how to perhaps notify the public of these floating bus stop for those that are blind and visually impaired. Perhaps some commercials can be done, like you guys run them on the TV to alert the public that these things are out there. Because if I'm a blind person I guess most people would be visually impaired that use, well, anybody uses. People are trained that are totally blind too. to alert them to know that these bus stops are out there, and to let them know where they are and why, because construction or whatever, that maybe some PR can be done.
Thank you, Vanessa. We have 10 minutes. How many public comments are there, Anu?
Dr. Posner would like to make some public comments and share
someone
some.
Else? Okay. Phil, do you want to make yours? Let me thank Melissa first, and we'll be back in touch. I guess we should, maybe if you can suggest the contact person at the Transportation Research Board, we'd appreciate that too.
But and I can, for now. Yeah, I can talk to you a little bit more about that offline. But thank you for having me.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Melissa.
Phil, you had a public comment?
Yes, things are changing that will affect the AAC. The board is planning on moving to in-person meetings at the new headquarters, starting the end of June. They are going to have hybrid meetings using Teams and in person. And I have requested that a program of travel training be set up for the AAC, particularly the low vision members of the AAC, as to one, how to get to the new headquarters, either from the bus, the rail, or a metro access vehicle. And secondly, once they are at the new headquarters, how do they get to the conference room so that they can speak? It is particularly important. For June, I will deliver the talk to the board via Teams. But starting in July, when the new GM has been announced to be in place, and September, there are also going to be changes in the makeup of the board. Their election committee met last week, so there may be a new board chair. There may be new members of the board. So things are changing. And certainly by September, every member of the AAC should feel confident that they can get to a board subcommittee meeting or a full board meeting so they can speak on issues that are critically important to our community. So this is a job I am throwing out to everybody. And Mr. Blake and Ms. Lopez are there, and I'm sure they can arrange to have the training done between now and September. But if you want to be effective members of this committee for your community, you have to learn how to get to the new headquarters. Because even if you're not the chair of any of the subcommittees or of the full AAC, you can speak as the public in person. And for them to see a face that is talking to them and a body that is talking to them is 300% more effective than writing an email or calling in from the phone. So that's my public comment. You got a job Phil, to do.
Phil, does that mean there won't be any virtual meetings at the board?
For this month, the month of June, it's going to be a hybrid meeting. So the board will be in person at headquarters, but I will be speaking via Teams. It will still be broadcast through the website and on YouTube. So you will be able to see it, but you won't be able to say anything except for me, who has the link. But come July, I think it's important that people show up and I will see if I can arrange a joint report to the board come July, and certainly by September, where we have the leadership. That would be the Queen, Denise, you, Tino, Paul, the chair of Metro Access, and Patrick, the immediate past chair, be able to go in person and talk to them about the AAC, talk about bus rail, and talk about Metro Access. That is my dream for September, because the new CEO will be there. The new board will be in place, and the new leadership of WMATA will be in place. We currently have met this month with the interim GM CEO, and tonight with the interim COO. But by September, the real people will be in charge. And again, just like it's important for us to put a face to the position, it's important for them to put a face to accessibility. So please, so think about getting about, trained and ready to go in September.
We're talking, yes, because you mentioned July at one point, but—
Well, if someone is early enough to do it in July, we can do it in July. But I think September, when everybody is in place, we can have them meet people. And again, the public can show up and speak at any board meeting. And so that can be anybody. It doesn't have to be the chair of bus rail, the chair of Metro Access, or the chair of the committee. And wouldn't it be nice, just like when people come up and complain about bus routes, to have 32 people come up and talk about something, to have the entire AC come up and everybody get their 3 minutes to talk about the things that we are working on. Everybody spoke tonight about floating bus stops. Well, everybody could have their 3 minutes to talk to the board about floating bus stops. Talked about fare evasion. So there's a lot of input at this meeting, and you can give it directly to the board. You don't have to give it to me to pass it on to the board. It's certainly more effective if they see you and hear you.
Hold on. This is Thomas. I just got a suggestion. Maybe for July, September maybe, we could have people that would like call different people that's part of the advisory board and see, do we want to set up a trip to go over there? Because some people are not gonna know how to get there at first. Some people might have problems trying to get to the building that's blind or they got visually impaired in some way. And some of us that use wheelchairs will have problems maybe with some of the sidewalks getting to the place. So we need to be over there and at least see where the place is and see the different areas leading up to the new building, so we be able to know what we have to do. Cause like people like myself, I call 311, I call the Department of Public Works. I do stuff to make sure the area is accessible going to wherever I might be going. So that would be helpful. Cause like you said, in September, you want everybody to be able to get there, but we have to learn how to do it before that happens. Or what have you. That's the what I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mangram. This is Anu.
Thank you. Excuse me. Anu, hi, this is B, and good afternoon, everyone. I just wanted to say that the Transit Accessibility will be happy to train the AAC members and the public that are interested. Members can, and the public can, send us an email at traveltraining@WMATA.com. And that's two words, traveltraining@WMATA.com. So you can do that, or you can contact us at 202-962-2703, and I think the team can, you know, work it in the schedule. Right now, I know the team, is most people are interested in returning. They've been quite busy. However, between now and September, I'm sure there's availability so that the members can get up to speed on how to get to the new building and to just have their way around in the new building, find the boardroom, maybe find the restroom.
It's six o'clock now. Could you give us your name before we adjourn? Could you give us your name before we adjourn? You're already listed as guest.
Tino, how are you today?
Who?
That was B, Morguen from Eligibility Office. All right.
That's terrific, but we also have to get together with the signage people so that the people that do have vision, we need to have signs in the rail station to get out, and we need to have signs on the sidewalk to get people there. So B, that's terrific. That will help with the travel training also. Okay. So that's fantastic.
Very good. So somebody provide the signs. There are at least three exits at L'Enfant Plaza, and they're spread apart. So we'll need really some guidance on that. Thanks for bringing it up, Phil. It is now 6:01. We are adjourned. Thank you.
Good meeting.
Thank you.
Thank you all. Have a great day.
You too, all.